First of all, Andre and Joe, thank you so much for joining us. I'm well aware that both of you have very, very busy practices and also do quite a bit of teaching and study and research, so we always welcome you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us.
Thank you very much, Cam.
So first of all, let me introduce Dr. Andre Fain, who really doesn't need an introduction. He's really one of the foremost homeopathic practitioners in the world today. Andre is just an immense scholar of homeopathy. Andre was born in Montreal, Quebec, and he graduated in 1982 from the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon. He's a board-certified homeopath from the Homeopathic Academy of Naturopathic Physicians, and he's been teaching and lecturing on homeopathy since 1985. One of his main focuses is in clinical work is the treatment of patients who are suffering from serious chronic diseases. And I like to attest to this because I, as many of you know, travel quite a bit all over the world. And I get to meet lots of different teachers. I go to a lot of different schools. I meet people who've been treated by homeopaths from all over the world. And I so frequently come into contact with some person who tells me that they were bedridden or crippled or in a wheelchair or on the verge of death, who were at some point treated by Dr. Fain and who were brought back to a complete state of health. And I really find this quite phenomenal because it's not that he's treating functional disorders. People come in with a sense of unease or some type of mild, functional type of problem, but really serious diseases, and through his mastery of pure homeopathy, he has been able to bring people back from a very sick state of health to really vibrant health. And this is a really astounding mastery of our science and art of homeopathy. Now, Dr. Fain is a very much sought-after teacher. He holds seminars in Canada, the United States, all over Europe, a well-known homeopathic scholar. Practices what's called pure Hahnemannian homeopathy. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. He also offers a 500-hour course on chronic prescribing for professionals. This is available on audio tape. And for many years, he's been working now on a massive scholarly work, a voluminous work on the subject of Dr. Adolf Lippe, who was one of the greatest prescribers in the history of homeopathy. Also, as I'll mention a little bit later and ask some more questions about, both Dr. Fain and Dr. Kellerstein are offering an excellent course starting. Joe, when is it actually starting, the course?
The course begins the weekend of October the 16th.
October the 16th, and that will be held in Toronto. And as I said, the opportunity to study with people of the caliber of Dr. Kellerstein and Dr. Fain is a real opportunity. They are both very like-minded. They're colleagues. They're people who have really mastered and studied the old literature and have been able to not only master it in their own practices, but have been able to take that mastery and be able to communicate it to their students so that their students can leave these classes and have greater success in their own practices. Now let me go ahead and introduce Dr. Joe Kellerstein. Dr. Kellerstein graduated from the University of Toronto in 1976. With a special focus and interest in physiology and zoology. And then he received his chiropractic degree in 1980 and then his naturopathic degree in 1984, graduating from the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine. He also graduated from the Canadian Academy of Homeopathy in 1991. Dr. Kellerstein has been in practice since 1983, providing both chiropractic and homeopathic care, and his principal homeopathic teachers included people like Andre Fain and Robin Murphy, and of course, all of the old great masters of our past. Dr. Kellerstein was the first chairman of the Department of Homeopathy with the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine, and he currently lectures on homeopathy at the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine, the Toronto School of Homeopathic Medicine, and he also offers his own postgraduate course in homeopathy, which is titled Homeopathy by the Book, which includes clinical preceptorship trainings for his students. Now, just as a quick aside, on top of being such a scholar and excellent practitioner of homeopathy, Dr. Kellerstein is just a wonderful educator. He has a very unique ability to clearly communicate the fundamental principles in the writings of the Organon. He actually has an excellent Organon course, which is available for purchase, and also other associated writings of like Hahnemann and many of the other masters, Lippe, Bunninghausen, Nash, and so on and so forth. I'd also like to say that Dr. Celestine is just a fabulous practitioner. I can remember a few years ago, I had the opportunity to participate in a clinic that he was offering where basically there were follow-up cases. And I don't remember exactly how many patients were coming for follow-up, but it was maybe 8, 9, 10 different follow-ups. And I remember the first patient came in, and Joseph, how are you doing? And the guy says, I'm so much better. My energy's improved. My mood is better. My physical symptoms are significantly improved as well. And I said, wow, fantastic. Now, of course, we all have successes like that in our own practice. But what was truly astounding was that for the rest of the day, pretty much everybody who came in communicated something very similar. And at the end of the day, it was like everyone had gotten much better. And I was very impressed because, you know, like I said, we all have success. But to have that level of consistency in your practice is something that's really unique and something I think we all strive for in our own practice. And just to put the icing on the cake with this whole thing, what was really wonderful was to see that his students in this class were coming up with the same remedy that he was, had the same understanding of how to follow up with the patient that he did. In other words, it wasn't that he had just mastered it, that he was the homeopathic guru out there putting on a magic show, but he was able to impart and instill in his students the same level of understanding. And consequently, this is how we can really grow and create good homeopathy for the future. So with that, Andre, have you joined us? Okay, I guess not. Perhaps Andre is having some type of technical difficulties. Anyway, Joe, I'll start. We can just start with you. I use this word pure homeopathy, and this is something that both you and Dr. Sain ascribe to, is this idea of pure homeopathy. Perhaps you could share with us what actually is pure homeopathy.
Well, I think in order to understand that, we have to go back in history. Just prior to the time or around the time of Samuel Hahnemann, there's a wonderful book on the subject by Elizabeth Danziger, who describes the state of medicine at the time. Medicine was a series of, there were a series of gurus, just let us say, and each had his own idea as to the nature of disease, what disease was, what went on in the interior of man that could create this kind of problem. And these were called rational schools of medicine, each with its own central idea, and they developed treatments, treatment regimes around this idea. You know, somebody might get the idea all disease is due to something, some acidity. Therefore, all treatment regimes had to be built around alkalinity, but none of them were subjected to the test of nature. That is, were they congruent with nature? Did it hit the road? Did it actually work? But each had their own school of rational medicine, which they defended on the basis of the, you know, it was just a really good idea. Hahnemann came around, and Hahnemann wanted something that was congruent with nature. He wanted a system of medicine that was not just internally consistent by virtue of patching it up with logical ideas, but he wanted something founded on a law of nature, and he wanted a system of medicine completely congruent with nature, based on experiment. So pure homeopathy, and I know you have some exceptions to this idea, Kim, but for the sake of it, pure homeopathy is based on something like the inductive method, where we gather pure observation. And the training in pure observation is not easy, as is very clearly shown in Hahnemann's wonderful article, The Medical Observer. But a system of medicine based on pure observation with reference only to the pure language of nature, that is, provings, and the gathering of subsequent clinical success added to that volume of knowledge. He wanted no speculative ideas to interfere with our perception of the patient. So when you're with the patient, there would be nothing there but you and essentially what is. no frame of reference, no prior paradigm. Pure homeopathy is that kind of assessment.
Fantastic. Joe, you know, if you're practicing pure homeopathy, can you give us a kind of an overview of exactly what, how are you actually implementing the practice of pure homeopathy, and how would you go about doing that exactly? Could you just give us a kind of a short description of that?
Well, it's a training. It's a long training, and it begins with the study of the organon. It begins with the study of pure materia medica, the study of cured cases. You know, pure materia medica is found in the literature of our pioneers, Hahnemann, Allen, Herring, Lippe, Guernsey, some of the fine old journals, and the clinical success that was added on, the clinical success as recorded in Herring. But then it also continues with the clinical skills. You know, for example, personally, one of my greatest challenges, I think, in practice, especially initially, was the ability to take a case. And, you know, we learn materia medica, but how do we get that kind of information? How do we get that kind of pure symptomatology that will guide us into the study of the materia medica? I remember one day I had a great deal of trouble with some cases of depression. You know, I would sit there and slug it out, try to get something that would smack of peculiarity in these cases. I was having a lot of difficulty. And I went to Andre. I had just begun studying with him at the time. I think it was 1986, 1987. And Andre gave me this fantastic piece of advice. And the piece of advice was, Joe, if you're not getting anything, if you're not getting any detail on what the depression is, anything that is amenable to, you know, to repertory study or materia medica study, chunk it down. Well, he didn't use that word, but I found later that was the idea. Chunk it down by saying, when you say depression, what do you mean? You know, for me, this was a revelation, because suddenly there was a linguistic pattern. There was a way of opening up the difficulty in interviewing patients, and I was to learn this was one of many, many other methods that led me to study these questioning techniques that have been so valuable in ascertaining that kind of information. You know, all of us study materia medica, and then we wonder, why am I not getting the kind of information that would match readily the things I'm reading in Herring and Allen, and trying to come up with the genius of a case in order to apply a successful remedy, you know, as per aphorism 153 in the Organon. And really, there's an awful lot of skill surrounding that. So for me, we have the clinical skills and the medical skills that are necessary on the one side, the academic skills on the other. Does that help?
Yeah, very much. You know, Joe, you mentioned aphorism 153. There's aphorism 151 and 153, where Hahnemann talks about the need to really define all of these various kind of collateral symptoms in the case. And then he also talks in aphorism 95 how, you know, these chronically ill patients become so accustomed to their long sufferings that they literally won't pay attention to these smaller, you know, but very important characterizing accompanying symptoms in the case. So do you have a particular questioning technique that you would use, or could you give us some examples of some of the things that you might use to elicit this sometimes, you know, forgotten information, which is so important in terms of finding the best remedy for the patient?
There are many. One of the things that is very important is exactly Andre's question. It's when you say X, what do you mean? It's a method of when somebody is actually giving you a piece of information that is too general, something you know that you know they've summarized, or they're trying to make convenient for you, or they have medicalized. You can use that question, you know, to the extreme. When you say X, what do you mean? If they give you another general, for example, when you say depression, what do you mean? Well, I mean I'm sad. Well, when you say sad, what's that about? What do you mean? And you can try to chunk down like that and be persistent until, now you know you're getting something closer to pay dirt when you get information that is adjectivally rich, in the sense that you can visualize in sensorially the suffering that person is going through, as if they were a prover. You know, approving is a first-person experience of illness. They're in the moment. They're describing what they feel in the moment. And that's the place that we often need to get a patient to. And in addition to getting their global observations of what's going on, we need them to associate to the discomfort to the level that it was almost as if they were walking through it right now, even if they're not suffering from it right now. So the first and foremost question is, when you say X, what do you mean? And you continue that until you get something reasonable. Now, the second thing is for the practitioner to really be there with the patient and to constantly say, how can I doubt my perception? You know, as opposed, you know, for example, I think one of the classic examples is everybody's gotten this kind of patient, the kind of situation where somebody comes in and says, gee, doc, I have low back pain, and you know, the low back pain is worse at night. You sit back and you say, well, how can I doubt that perception? How can I question it? So when you say at night, what exactly do you mean? Well, when I lie down to go to bed, I discover that my back really hurts. And then you might say, oh, when you lie down, well, what if you lie down in the daytime? Suddenly, the symptom may not be worse at night. It may be worse lying down. So this kind of mental activity needs to be going on constantly, constantly searching for exactly what it is you ought to be perceiving. Sometimes it's difficult to associate a person to the state of illness. So you might use a question such as, if I were observing you, when your disease was at its height, what would I really notice? What would be especially particular about that experience? So in this way, you're asking the person to actually take a position observing themselves while they're sick, and then at that point it becomes easier to get them to associate to the actual disturbance, and you can get a description far richer in adjectives, description, and nuance, something that you can really get into the books with.
Fantastic, Joe. Andre, have you joined us by any chance at this point? Okay, I spoke to Andre just a little while ago before the call started, so I'm assuming there must be some technical issue or some other thing. Anyway, Joe will continue on, and I guess if Andre joins us, he'll just pipe it at any point. So, you know, what you're describing here is fantastic, Joe, in terms of really creating a precise symptom that we can match to the symptoms that we find in our provings. Now, one of the things that, you know, many students find very difficult is actually reading through a proving. It's this morass of symptomology, and sometimes, you know, you just get lost in the information. I'm curious, how do you address the actual proving information? Do you focus, you know, mostly on the information that's found in Materia Medica Pura and in Timothy Field Allen's Encyclopedia of Pure Materia Medica, or do you read some of the more secondary works? What are your favorite books in terms of studying Materia Medica, and how do you actually approach the actual study?
Well, you know, to begin this study, I like to do something more bite-sized and chewy rather than swallow the whole buffet all at once. It tends to give one indigestion, and I don't think it's necessarily appropriate. So what I'll do is I'll pick a book that I find written by an author that I enjoy reading, you know, that attracts my mind. So I enjoy Nash. I enjoy Harvey Farrington. I enjoy Margaret Tyler. And personally, I find them easy for me to remember. There are other books like Neatby and Stoneham, very good bite-sized descriptions, good summaries, and very reliable. So I'll read something that I find enjoyable, And I'll try to really come to grips with what this author has to say about the main points of the remedy. Then I'll migrate to a book with a little bit more depth, and ultimately make my way to the proving. By that time, I do have some expectations. I understand some of the things I might be looking for. By the way, Boger's Synoptic Key is also very useful that way because he really summarizes a lot of main features of many of the provings. So by then, I've got some idea. I have a ladder that I'm climbing. And, you know, students will often try to tackle a proving before they're conversant with much materia medica, and it's just so daunting. It's too much. We've got to begin in a place, always begin at a place that's okay and interesting, that keeps your mind attracted and focused. Because just as the Organon is often an excellent cure for insomnia, reading a proving is a great way to get a migraine. So ultimately, I'll make my way to Hahnemann. From Hahnemann, I'll go through Allen and then Herring. And at each point, I'm always saying, what do I find especially striking and peculiar here in this proving? What would I notice in somebody on the hoof with this problem? And how would I notice it? And if I did notice it, then I might even go further and say something to the effect of, well, you know, how would I frame a question so as to indirectly access this kind of information? And that'll help me remember it. So we'll go through things that way, and I'll take notes as I go through. But the way you really cement it in the end is by reading cured cases. When you read cured cases and you model mentally the thought processes of the old masters, that's when it all congeals into something. That's when you can really recognize, oh, this is what he saw clinically. This is what I'd see, hear, feel, touch if I was doing an examination. And when you do that, I can't overemphasize, Kim, you've got to maintain the fascination. We're all here in homeopathy because we're addicted. We're addicted to this wonderful system of healing that Hahnemann gave us. And we want to get the best results possible. And you know what? I want that for my students. So, because, you know, one day I'll be needing them. And we've got to maintain that drive, that joy, that pleasure. There's an immense amount of work that needs to be done, but it's got to be done, I think, under those auspices. So you finish it up with the cured cases. And the cured cases are in the old literature. They're in places like your wonderful program, literature databases, if you can find the actual journal, if a library is near you. But that, you know, that's the way. And then, you know, the real final touch, the real test is, do you know it well enough to see it in person? And for that, personally, I found mentoring was extremely important. It was important for me to see a few live cases, to see what it looks like in real life, not just in the book. You know, I had the very good fortune to preceptor and study with somebody like Andre, where I could see that he applied what he said, he applied what Hahnemann said, I could see and assess the results for myself, and then, because it was according to clear and comprehensible principles, just as dictated in the Organon, I could go, and after a while of practice, I found, hey, I can actually do this, you know? It's not like, I remember a class I once taught where people said, I asked people, how are you doing? I mean, are you seeing real cures in clinic? Or are you just seeing people's energy just improve? Are you actually seeing pathologies getting better? And they said, well, you know, if we just study at the feet of the guru another 5-6 years, then maybe we'll see something. It's great for faith, but I didn't have to have that. I saw Andre get real results in the here and now. And you know, to some degree, to whatever abilities I might have at present, I've been able to reproduce that. And that's what I want for people.
Joe, you know, you've been mentioning some of these old-time homeopaths, you know, starting with Hahnemann, but also people like Adolf Lippe, Constantine Herring, Bunninghausen, Guernsey, Phineas Parkhurst Wells, Carol Dunham, you know, Eugenio Boharis Nash, and Harvey Farrington also you mentioned, you know, these really great practitioners from the past. In your opinion, what would you say is really different about the type of homeopathy they practice? I think you would probably define that as a type of pure homeopathy compared to some of the different types of homeopathy that are being practiced today.
Tim, some of the sound is breaking up. Are you hearing me correctly?
Yeah, too. I don't know where it's coming from.
Okay.
A crackling sound, yeah.
Okay. I think the primary difference is a lot of the modern authors ask us to have some type of paradigm, some type of thought pattern in mind that we're actually looking for. And we may be looking for a miasm. We may be looking for a central delusion or a vital sense. This has to be very carefully assessed. Hahnemann says in the Medical Observer that it's rare to meet with a truly impartial, pure observer, especially a doctor. We've all got our own axe to grind. Hahnemann talks about this Zen-like state of awareness, where we're focused on the task at hand, where nothing is prior to that. We only want to know what is with accuracy. And so for me, the art of case-taking, observing people like Andre, involved in the art of case-taking, involved in judging symptoms, and then going to a totally reliable materia medica and applying that reliability to the presumed reliability in the proving, and then assessing and watching for myself in clinical practice. And you know, Kim, it's been fantastic. But in the old days, when I was more used to some of the more modern methods myself, because I studied them, and I very much respect these imaginative people, but for me, this kind of practice of pure homeopathy, just what is the symptoms sculpted out as best as I can and compared to a full and rich proving, for me, that's homeopathy, and it's worked. And when you compare that kind of cure to the cures you see in the old literature, you suddenly feel this marvelous connection back in through time to these geniuses. You understood what they were seeing and doing and where they came from. And it's this incredible rush that I have to say is one of the great pleasures in life. You know, if you follow the thinking paradigm of somebody who's very brilliant, modern, who's offering you a lens through which to see homeopathy, then forever you will be that person's student. When you follow the work of Hahnemann, he insists you become your own doctor and acquire your own experience and test what he says for yourself. It's a huge difference, isn't it?
Hi, Kim. I've been on for the last 10 minutes, and I'm enjoying Joe speaking.
Okay, great. I'm glad to hear you're on, Andre. That's fantastic.
So I don't know what was said in the first 25 minutes. So,
no problem. No problem. We're glad to have you join us.
I don't want to repeat any things.
No, that's okay. We'll move on. Joe, did you finish? Did you want to finish that point?
No, I think I've finished the point.
So, you know, actually, I'd like to ask both of you a question. It's a good question. I think an interesting question, because it's a subject which I think there's a lot of confusion about in the homeopathic community. I actually was in Texas just this last weekend. I was invited to do a presentation there on the use of miasms and nozodes in homeopathic practice. And before I started my presentation, I asked everybody what they thought about miasms, and I wrote down all the various little points that they wrote down. And at the end, I said, "Well, you know, none of this has anything to do with Hahnemann's conception of miasms, and this is not the way that Hahnemann practiced. He didn't use miasms in this way." It created quite a bit of stir in the audience, because most people had adopted certain belief systems about what miasms were and how to use them in practice. So I'm curious if the two of you could speak to the subject a little bit about, in terms of how you see miasms, what you find that they have in your practice, and perhaps a little bit about what Hahnemann's conception of miasmas were.
Go ahead, Andre.
Well, it's a very complex question. I don't think a few minutes will give we would be able to answer that question. But if we summarize it, for Hahnemann, a miasm was the concept of the time, which was originally it was being contaminated from the fumes, the emanation from marshes. That's the old meaning of miasm. But eventually, miasm in medicine, throughout the time of Hahnemann and before the time of Hahnemann, miasm came to mean a state of being infected. And so you were infected with either an acute or a chronic miasm. So an acute force or influence that would be contagious, or a chronic influence that would be contagious. Hahnemann developed the concept of he was looking, earlier Hahnemann was at the remedy that are mostly contained in the Mathe Medica Pura, which is remedy often would there were medicine that were used throughout the history of medicine, oftentimes for acute condition, sometimes for pain and relief of acute symptoms. So therefore, like belladonna or nux vomica or opium, these were remedy contained in the first remedy that Hahnemann would be using. And he noticed that he was able to relieve people of acute problem with these medicine, but people would keep their chronic disease would continue to evolve, and they would continue to have acute problems. And then he was thinking, what is the reason why people continue to have chronic problems? And he thought about it for a long, long time, and he looked at syphilis as a model. And in syphilis, which was syphilis is a very particular type of disease where it will have so many types of manifestation on every organ of the body that William Osler says, if you know syphilis, you know medicine. That means you're such a good diagnostician that to be able to differentiate this skin eruption from syphilis, that means you know medicine very well. So with syphilis, you have it's an infectious condition, so you have a contact with a person that is already infected. You have a prodrome. Afterwards, you have an eruption on the skin, which is the canker, and it will affect every organ of the body. Using that model of syphilis, Hahnemann applied this to scabies. Scabies was ubiquitous throughout Europe. Now, if most people would get scabies, it was everywhere, once at least in their life. And the treatment for scabies was to apply an external ointment on the skin. And by the application of this ointment, the mite would die, but also the skin eruption would be suppressed. And Hahnemann had reported in this chronic disease that so many physicians in the history of medicine have mentioned the development of chronic prolonged disease, serious disease after the suppression of skin eruption, that Hahnemann concluded that the most important reason why people are chronically sick is from the suppression of scabies or other form of skin eruption. He mentioned other form of skin eruption that were more popular at other times in the history of medicine. So he modeled this after the syphilitic infectious condition with all its many manifestations. And here we have all the many manifestations of chronic disease that he was seeing in this time and that we also witnessed today. And he related that to a suppressed skin eruption, especially scabies. The model doesn't hold anymore today because we know better about syphilis and we know better about scabies and so on. However, Hahnemann did develop a Mathe Medica to address chronic disease, and those remedies remained the same. So the theory, the understanding that Hahnemann had, because he didn't say it was a theory, he says, this is the understanding that I have from all research that I've been able to do. We have so much more knowledge now in terms of microbiology, immunology, genetics, that now the word, the idea of biasm of Hahnemann doesn't hold anymore. However, the concept of a chronic infectious disease creating disease, that's very well accepted and so on. However, the reason why people are chronically sick, we cannot come down to a skin eruption necessarily or a skin, previous skin eruption in the parents and so on. We cannot demonstrate that. However, we know from genetics that we are susceptible to disease. We're born susceptible. Being alive is to be sensitive, and being sensitive means we're going to be sensitive to influences, and we will be affected by different influences. And genetically, it's greatly determined. And if we go through life and we're stressed, we're going to break down eventually. We will not be able to adapt anymore. And in this breaking down, the organism does not recover. This is all well described by Hahnemann in the chronic disease. If you remove the part of suppressed skin eruption and you just introduce the concept of be genetically susceptible and with the stress of life, the combination of stress of life, you have the development of chronic disease. So there's a lot of truth in Hahnemann's idea of cause of chronic disease, but there are today, with more knowledge about science, we can see it in a different perspective. However, the Mathematica, the chronic disease that Hahnemann developed for addressing chronic disease, is a great, great development in the history of medicine.
You know, I'm curious because, you know, now in terms of miasms, you know, they divide SORA into functional disorder associated with deficiency and psychosis with excessive growth and syphilis with destruction. But, you know, if you read the chronic diseases, Hahnemann attributes to SORA, you know, the whole gambit of different health problems, including, you know, curvature of the spine and cancerous growth and tumors. And can either of you speak to how this development occurred, where Hahnemann's conception of the different miasms was changed in contemporary homeopathy?
Yeah, I can say a small word on it. I don't think that's a very, very important. Miasm was not very important among Hahnemannian homeopaths. Not many people talk about it, and they didn't use it much clinically. Benninghausen made some mention about psychosis and tuya, but it was especially related to smallpox. In other words, he had seen that the eruption of a similar eruption that you see in smallpox can come out by taking in the proving of tuya, and he used tuya extensively to treat people with smallpox. And that was the main antipsychotic remedy of Hahnemann, tuya. So there was not much talk in the Hahnemannian's writings about, they didn't use the concept of miasm very extensively. However, Kant started to lecture on the miasm more extensively, and from there were John Allen that did extend it a bit further. Him and Kant went a bit too far with introducing the cardinal sins of the, or the capital sin, I think, of the Catholic Church, which the SORA would be the main sin and the original sin, and that syphilis begins when you start to think of copulating with an unmarried person, when you're unmarried. So it went a bit too far, and from there, you know, you start to deviate with Kant, and the deviations start to go further and further, and the idea that destruction would be associated with syphilis came at the turn of the 20th century, like the early 1900s. People were talking about it, and then, you know, he went to South America. It grew a bit further, and it's blown and blown and blown and blown. So then, nowadays, a little deviation became a complete, like, miles away from the original concept of Hahnemann. So it became a very theoretical world, a thing of miasm. And for Hahnemann, it was a very, very practical question. It was how to cure people with chronic disease, how to deal with people that have an acute disease and a chronic disease at the same time, how to deal with people with dissimilar disease. So it was a very, very practical question, and now it became a theoretical question. There's people in South America developing Mathematica for psoric and remedies, the psoric symptom, and another material for psychosis and so on. It went out of board. The one of the key questions in all of this is the first paragraph of the Organon, which says, you know, the role of the physician, the footnote, says the role of the physician is, of course, is to, the primary mission of the physician is to heal the sick. But in the footnote, it says, you know, all this this discussion, theoretical discussion, has to be left for others, not for a real physician.
Fantastic. Andre, I want to just change subjects, because I know you're doing a lot of work now with Materia Medica. And could you just share a little bit about, I think this work is very important. I think it would be useful for people to be familiar with the work that you're doing right now.
Yes. What we're doing is I start to teach a course on Materia Medica. It's a 7-year course in Europe. And so in teaching the Materia Medica, I put down 500 remedies or 500-plus remedies that needs to be reviewed in a certain order. I took 12 acute remedies, the most used remedy, and the 12 of the most used chronic remedy. And from these, I associate all the remedies that are close to these either 12 acute or 12 chronic remedies. So we study them by comparison, which is the traditional way of studying the Materia Medica since Ehring introduced the diagnostic method of studying the Materia Medica. Now, by doing this, so if I have to teach a remedy, I will review all the literature I can find on this remedy. So all the proving and all the cure case on the remedy and all the clinical experience I can find. So what happens is our main Materia Medica, which is hearing guiding symptom and Allen Encyclopedia, were written, the last edition, the last volume were in 1890. So the first volume were in the 1870s. So from, you could say, for the last 140 years, more or less, the Materia Medica has not grown much because the Clark Dictionary is just a repeating of previous, a lot of repetition of previous Materia Medica. Similar with Borky, it's a synopsis. And Julian has published, and Stevenson has published, like new proving. But there was no great effort to look at, to assemble in one view, all the proving of a remedy and all the cure case of a remedy. When you do this work, you assemble all the cure case and all the proving, and you read them in a chronological order, something magical happens. You start to see the evolution of symptoms. You start to see the genius of the remedy starting to appear from the proving and the cure case, and the more when a case is published, practitioners start to see a new picture, and they start to prescribe it more often, a remedy, and the picture start to evolve. You start to get new modality, new sensation, new symptom, and the image, the most characteristic images of a remedy start to emerge, and it's really, really beautiful. And it's very unfortunate because as a profession, we have been very delinquent to do this work. In other ways, since Hearing Die, or since the guiding symptoms were published in 1890, and Allen's Encyclopedia similarly, we have not continued their work. And by doing this, it's totally amazing. And on top of this, what we do is, besides assembling all the material and creating a genius that we've never had before, we've never seen before. We were never able to see the genius of the remedy because we had not assembled all the proving and all the cure case. So by doing this, what we are also doing is we're adding to the repertory all the symptoms, the confirmation of symptoms, the new provings of the cure case, the confirmation. So our repertory now will represent the reality of what we know in homeopathy, even though it's in the journal, but once it's out and you read it, you start to put it back in the repertory. Our repertory become very, very rich and become very powerful tools now to identify remedies before you will never have been able to identify. For instance, right now as I'm talking to you, or just as I was trying to join this this lecture, I was working on Trillium Pendulum. And Trillium Pendulum looks like a very, very small remedy. And actually, the lecture is about 37 pages. I was very surprised by this. And I think I've added to the repertory, I would say probably close to 500 symptoms to the repertory on Trillium Pendulum. I mean, it's a very, very small remedy. But, you know, it's just amazing. Or sometimes you'll have older remedy, let's say, or older, I mean, from the time of Hahnemann. Let's say, like nitricum acidum. Last year, when we present nitricum acidum to the class, I think, if I remember good, I added to the repertory something like 1,800 symptoms of a remedy that is already well known. So it's, the repertory becomes very, very rich, and then it's very easy to find the information because all the symptoms are, we add it according to the reference where it comes from, so it's very easy to find the reference. And if you cannot find the reference, it will be in the lecture. The lecture will have the reference. So every edition we have, the reference is in our lecture.
Andre, I know you're doing this, you're starting in January of 2011, this International Hahnemannian Study Group. Does some of this information get communicated during this 10-week course that you offer?
Occasionally. Sometimes somebody will ask me some question on the remedy occasionally, but no, this is a webinar course. You know, it's not, people don't have to move. They stay in their home to listen to that. It's a, more or less a group discussion where I will present some topics. Every month I will present some topics of interest, very interesting topics, and sometimes cases, and I will give them homework, paper to read, case to prepare for, and I correct their answer to the case, and I say, no, it's not good. You have to go back and work again on your case. And then eventually we have the webinar, and I present the case, I present the answers, and I discuss the paper that I had them to read for very specific point of interest. Like, for instance, the last webinar we had was about 2 weeks ago, and I had them read a case of cases by Nash that he had published at the turn of the century, where he had a case, I will try to remember now, of syphilis. If I remember good, it was a case of syphilis in the person that had very, very strong bone pain. And I cannot recall exactly the case, but Nash had given a high potency to the person, and she did not respond. And finally, he gave her a low potency, a mother tincture, I believe, and the patient recovered wonderfully well. On the other hand, he had another case of syphilis, if I recall well, and in this case, he gave the highest potency that he had found, and it was a DMM, so it would be a 500 million dilution of Swan potency, and just, he didn't say how many doses, but very quickly the patient recovered totally. These were very advanced cases of syphilis, at least one case was a very advanced case of syphilis, and the other one, was very strong bone pain. But the point is that was presented was the discussion of what Nash had mentioned so many times, but I had not seen the evidence yet. He had seen, I use crude matter to the highest of potency. Okay, crude matter, no, I don't use crude matter in my practice, and I don't see the place to use it. But he brought a case where he used the mother tincture, and the person recovered so wonderfully well that there was no doubt it was the right remedy, and it was, to some degree, we could say the right potency. So it brought a lot of food for thought about, are there cases where we'll respond better to a crude dose? And Nash said yes, and he demonstrated. And he says, I have many other cases I could demonstrate. And this is really food for thought, to think about it, because in practice I typically use the medium to the very high potency. Sometimes in very sensitive people I'll use the low potency, but to use the crude, I've never thought of that. And that brings us to to Cooper, the British homeopath, who Robert Cooper, who were treating very, very serious cases with one drop of the mother tincture. And I recall just now I just came across a case of Bolger at the turn of the century, which he, 1906, which he, I believe 1906, which he treated a case with one drop of the tincture of mother tincture of Trillium. And he was asked, it was presented before the International Immune Association, he was asked, why did you use the mother tincture? And he said, because I was reading Cooper and I wanted to try it, and it worked wonderfully well.
Very interesting. I want to give other people an opportunity to ask some questions, but I just want to quickly talk about the course in Toronto. Can you first of all tell us where the course is actually being taught and how long and how often the course will be running?
Joel?
The course is going to be held at the Naturopathic College here in Toronto, and it's beginning in October, approximately once a month for 10 months. Now, for those people who cannot make a particular weekend, there will be audio recordings of the weekends available together with whatever lecture materials were handed out.
Fantastic. And Joe, what can people expect to gain by participating in these classes?
The framework of the course has been designed to impart to people the practical components necessary to begin a homeopathic practice. We want to focus on the prime skills of case taking, case analysis, how to do a careful and appropriate follow-up, how to deal with difficult cases. In addition to that, we want to begin the materia medica of the top 24 remedies, as Andre outlined in his mode of association, so that we lay the foundation for the comparative study of materia medica for people. We'll have live case taking so that people can observe what we're talking about in action. If people wish, students in the course are welcome to come and preceptor with me so that they can observe in a clinical setting. Do we do as we teach, and are there results? And they can assess for themselves. So what can a person gain by this? Hopefully a good and sound basis for the beginning of a pure homeopathic practice.
Fantastic. And Joe, is there a certain level the student needs to be at or the participant needs to be at to be able to benefit from this course?
Well, I haven't discussed it specifically with Andre, but I think the way I would take it is that we would prefer students have some beginning foundation in homeopathy. So either homeopaths, naturopaths, people that have had some homeopathic grounding, so that it's not too steep a learning curve for them. What do you think, Andre?
Well, I think the course is open for everybody except for real, real beginner. You want people with a basis of homeopathy, and you want also experienced people that are not sure what they're doing. They need orientation, because we're going to give them a foundation that they will never deviate from, they should not deviate from. We're going to orient them in the right direction. We're going to give them all the basis of all the important clinical subjects, like case-taking, how to prescribe the remedy in terms of the pathology, how to do follow-up, and so on. And in terms of the philosophy of homeopathy, if people understand well this strong foundation, you will build your career, a very, very successful career on it. You know, if we're going to point people in the right direction, if they follow the direction, they're going to be very, very, very successful.
Fantastic. If people want more information about the course in Toronto, how could they get that information?
They can go to homeopathy.ca, www.homeopathy.ca, and they can look at, I'll do it right now, they can look at the section which will say live courses, and it will say Hahnemann Prescribing.
Fantastic.
We'll have a lot of information there.
Okay, very good. And actually, your website is full of excellent information, many excellent articles both by yourself and other people, so it's well worth visiting just if you're interested in homeopathy in general. Let me go ahead. We still have a few minutes here. I'd like to open up the lines and let some other people ask some questions, so let me go ahead and do that. So any questions for Dr. Sain and Dr. Kellerstein?
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
For those of us in the States, will that be available as a webinar-based course, or no, it's just live?
There's two things. There's the course with Dr. Sain and Dr. Kellerstein in Toronto, and I think, Joe, you mentioned that it's going to be recorded.
Yeah, we're going to be recording the weekends, the live weekends, so that if people can't make a particular weekend or two, then they will get they will have missed nothing.
Okay, and then there's also the course that Andre is offering, Dr. Sain is offering, called the International Hahnemannian Study Group, where there would be a particular topic that would be discussed and people would have an opportunity to work on and would be ultimately reviewed by Dr. Sain. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, other questions for Dr. Sain and Dr. Kellerstein?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I have one question and one comment. I appreciate Dr. Kellerstein for emailing me George Von Keller's article. For Dr. Sain, I have one question. In December 2000, when the late Julian Winston wrote a review of Nancy Herrick's book, Animal Mind and Human Voices, an argument started between you and Roger Morrison, which lasted about two and a half years. And other homeopathic practitioners joined for you, like Anton Rother and George Dimitriadis. I've read all those articles, and they were very enlightening many times. I utterly and absolutely believe that your arguments were extremely sound and valid. Recently, when Kim interviewed Roger and Nancy, to my surprise and astonishment, not changed even a bit. They are the same as they were 10 years ago. Now, I'm not concerned about the future of these practitioners. I'm more worried about when students are victims of or entrapped by such practitioners. Is there any accountability when they wasted the time and money of poor students? My suggestion is that at least contemporary Hahnemannians like you and Joseph Kellerstein start some kind of accountability bureau or something like that, that we can hold people accountable, for these practitioners accountable.
Homeopathy is a very young profession. The one of the nemesis of homeopathy is a poor system of education. We cannot say, maybe except for certain country, perhaps like India, where a person says, I would like to practice homeopathy, and they go to school and they graduate with the highest standard in the profession, like you would do, let's say, if you want to become a dentist. In homeopathy, it doesn't exist. So if there would be a dental school where there would be 5% of graduates would eventually be successful in practice, I think that school would close by itself. There would be no more people applying for it. And that's perhaps what's happening in the world today. You know, we had a conference, several conferences actually, international conference, where people from different countries, they would tell their experience about the number of people actually practicing homeopathy after taking a 2, 3, or 4 year postgraduate course. Like, most country will reporting, perhaps except for India, like I said, about the 5 to 10% percent of people that would actually be in practice after a few years of trying to homeopathy. In other ways, the teaching in homeopathy is so poor and so confused that people are not able to practice successfully homeopathy. They just drop it. And you can see the popularity of homeopathy is going down everywhere in the most places in the world right now. It's going down. There's less subscription to journal. There's less people in association. There's everything is less. Why? Because of this confusion that has been dispersed with all this false teaching. But this is not the first time it happened in homeopathy. Homeopathy will always survive these kind of false teacher area, at times, period. And this is what we're going through right now. So there's no really accountability, but, you know, those people, they'll be forgotten, and homeopathy will survive pure homeopathy will survive and will always be there. But all this is like I mentioned one day, it's like the branch of a sequoia. The lower branch will fall out. You will forget them. But what will stay will always be the strong trunk of homeopathy, of the sequoia tree.
Great. For just one more question before we'll have to end the call. So one more question for either Dr. Telestine or Dr. Sane.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I've been taking David Little's online course, and I'm wondering how your practice is similar or different to what he's teaching, because he's also saying that he's teaching Hanumanian, and everybody's saying they're doing the same thing, but I'm not sure if they are or not, because as you said, there's so little clarity among people about what they really mean by things.
I cannot comment on David Little's course because I've never taken it. However, I know that he still promotes the coupons, and he says this is pure Hanumanian. However, we are not inclined to that. We teach, we use the teaching of Hanuman in the spirit of Hanuman and of the Hanumanians, the great Hanumanians, like Sleepy and Herring and Guernsey and Wells and Bayard. So the great practitioner of homeopathy, Bunning Austin, the success they had. The success they had, the fantastic success they had, was with the higher and the highest potency. So there's a whole world there that Hanuman actually touched that world, but not for very long. Maybe for 8 years he was using the 200 potency. But we have thousands of practitioners that have used the highest and highest potency. So our course is not limited only to Hanuman, but it's to the Hanumanians, the one that have made the practice of homeopathy even more successful and have developed further homeopathy like the great Hanumanians.
Fantastic. Joe, did you want to add anything before we sign off?
No, it was well said.
Okay, good. Everybody give Dr. Celestine and Dr. Sane a very big thank you. These are some of the best practitioners we have in our community. They're both extremely busy, and for them to take the time out of their very busy lives to join us is really a great favor on their part. So can everyone say a big thank you?
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe and Andre. And we'll send more information about their course materials out to everybody on the mailing list, so if people want to follow up later, they can do that. And thank you again, everybody.